Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Getting There, the podcast with me, Brogan. And I could not be more thrilled that today's episode has been brought to you by Never Fully Dressed. And today I am joined by the incredible Ella McChrystal, a renowned psychotherapist, speaker, and trauma specialist whose work has transformed lives across the world. Ella is someone who doesn't just understand the human mind, she helps people rebuild it from the inside out. And today we dive deep into a conversation that feels more urgent than ever. The impact social media and the internet are having on our children, on our self-image, and on the very fabric of our communities. We explore the blurred lines between reality and the digital world and what it means to grow up or to simply live in this age of constant comparison and hyper connection. We talk about the courage it takes to have difficult conversations at home, the ones that truly matter, and why those conversations might be the key to real, lasting change. Ella also shares how we can begin to reprogram our brains, reshape our beliefs, and return to something more grounded, more honest, and more human. This episode isn't just about awareness, it is about action. It's about healing, and it's about hope for our community. Let's get into it. Crystal, how are you?
Very well, because I'm here with you and you know I love you.
Yeah, I know. Ever since we met, honestly, you've had the most incredible energy. And I know we've been trying to match up dates for a little while. Nearly got it wrong, guys. I was here 2 days early, which makes a difference because I probably would have been 2 days late.
I was so excited to get the message and I was like, this might be delayed because she's booked it on the wrong.
But I'd booked it, but I hadn't booked it with myself, and that's what happens in life. That's the chaotic ADHD of me.
Yes.
Which I know we have just been discussing off camera. Yeah. Anyone who listens to my podcast know I have a real issue with the term ADHD, but we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
But we were talking about earlier, actually, ADHD and trauma going hand in hand.
Yeah.
So what are the impacts of early childhood trauma on us? Because I did the Hoffman process, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And guys, if you're listening, it's 8 days residential retreat.
Hardcore.
Yeah, hardcore. Like 36 pages of homework. Yep. Takes like 8 hours. No watches, no clocks, no telephones, no communication with the outside world. And childhood stuff.
Yeah.
And we talked about the inner critic and things like that. But to put that into layman's terms, anyone who's listening is like, what's my inner critic? It's the dark voice that's inside of
my head. Like the bully, the one that says you're stupid, the one that says, oh, you'll never be able to do that. You know, other people are better than me because they've got this or they look like that and they've got more money or they've got a better house or whatever it is. It's that part of you that's probably heard these things before. You're stupid. Just get up and get on with it. That girl over there, she's prettier than you. You've got to try harder. It's those things.
For me, when I walk past the mirror, it goes, oh, your chin, your double chin. Do you know what I mean? It's that voice that's always stopping us.
Yeah.
But so is our inner critic or the shadow part of ourselves, is that made in early years or?
So I'm going to try and keep it simple.
Yes, please.
Think of the brain in three parts. So you've got the back of the brain, the reptilian brain, which is where your brainstem is, links to the rest of you. Then you've got the middle of the brain, which is the limbic system. And that part is the emotional centre. So think about the amygdala in particular, which is like a danger tracker, but it also helps to process emotions. That comes next. So you've got reptilian, mammalian, and then the front part of the brain, which is prefrontal cortex. The front part is the last to develop, and that takes until your mid-20s to fully develop. The emotional brain, and think about the drive of emotion, especially in children, it's pleasure, it's danger. You know, if you say to a child, don't touch that, it's hot, they don't know what hot is until they've touched it. Mm. So they've always got to experience the pain and have the emotion of, ouch, that hurts. And that's really important for children to have those experiences. The problem comes when your experiences are repeatedly being told you're not enough, or repeatedly being around people that make you feel like you're not enough. Now, that could just be neglect. It could be abuse. It could be bullying. It can be words. It could be actions. So we're talking about sexual, physical and verbal abuse. Those things, even if your parents or your caregivers or your teachers don't realise they're doing it to you, the things that people say and do around you will have a profound effect on the emotional centre. Because the prefrontal cortex, which, think of that as the CEO of the brain, isn't developed until mid-20s, you can't analyse it, you can't rationalise it, you can't logicalise it. So organising the information that's in there is impossible until you start to develop complex thinking. You need your caregivers and your society, the village, to help you decide who you are. If that's not functional and it's dysfunctional, your opinions of yourself will be dysfunctional too.
And at what age is it most informative? Because I've read something and I've come down saying like between zero and seven are really informative years for our subconscious or inner critic.
They are. So because the prefrontal cortex, so go back to that, it's the front that doesn't develop until about mid-20s. There's no fusion there at all between the ages of 0 to 7. So think of it as like your brain is got this big gap at the front. So everything is going in completely unfiltered.
Like a sponge.
Yeah, okay. Essentially like a sponge. And there's no way of organising that information. It's just hitting the emotional centre. Now, the very back of the brain, the reptilian brain, that's where your cerebellum is. And that's like your hard drive. So it's where all long-term memories and just automatic movements are held. So that's the first to develop. So when you see a baby lift its head or, you know, walking, talking, all of that's coming from the reptilian brain. Then the mammalian brain, the emotional brain, is second. So, of course, 0 to 7, when there's no filter at all, everything's going. A child will literally believe anything you tell them at that age. They believe in Santa Claus and fairies and, you know, magic dust and all this sort of stuff. And that's good. But if you're telling them stuff about them that is not so good, you're too fat, you're too stupid. If they're humiliated in front of the class by a teacher that's just a bit of a bully, you know, those things you become very sensitive to and you believe. At the age of 7, it starts to fuse, but it's not fully developed, like I said, until mid-20s. So you're developing. So, of course, you can do some complex thinking by the age of 11, but that complex thinking is the 11-year-old's complex thinking, not an adult. So you're still taking in information based on a child's perspective. But the middle of the brain is driven by pleasure and wants to sort of be excited by life. So if you're giving a child lots of negatives, that's all they can go on. And of course, your brain will wire around that.
Well, as a mum to a 4-year-old, it's like...
Scary.
Petrifying. Because I feel like when we were kids, we were getting programmed by our caregivers and school. And now they're being... we'll get into this later, but being programmed by phones.
Yeah.
And social media and the internet and YouTube and all of this stuff that is... For me, it's not a reality, but their brains can't decipher what's a reality.
No, they can't.
And it's a really worrying place to be. And also, I had to tell my son off this week, which everyone's been like, oh, what do you mean? But no, guys, I lost my shit. and it was a really challenging thing for me because I want him to be scared.
Yeah.
But I actually don't think there's something wrong for being a little bit fearful of your parents.
No.
Whereas I'm a bit of a joke. Like, and then I thought, no, this has to change. Like, he needs to take me seriously, but it's having that fine line. And after I did tell him off, I could see he was like been walking about like a toy soldier since. Yeah. And then there was part of me was like, oh God, have I triggered anxiety? Have I done this? It's that fine balance between actually, I grew up fearful of my parents and I don't know, is that a bad thing? Is it not a good thing? It seems like discipline is on a very thin line now.
Mm. I think there's a fine line between fear and respect, you see. So I mean, if you make a child scared, then their whole processing, their brain's processing is around fear of you rather than respect. So respect is about boundaries and it's about making those boundaries logical for the child. So, for example, I said earlier about don't touch that, it's hot.
Yeah.
Well, they need to know what hot feels like. So you don't want to be the sort of parent that says, be careful, be careful, be careful. They need to understand consequences and then they will respect why you're asking something of them. So you might say to them, look, remember last time you touched that, it was really, really hot. I don't want you to do that again. If you do that again, the consequence is that it will hurt and that's not going to be good for anybody. It's up to you.
Yeah, me and my sister were out, and Henry was like playing on this thing where he could have fallen, not like far. And she's like, Brogan, he's going to fall. And I was like, he'll fall once.
Yeah.
Like, and guys, we're talking like 30 centimetres off the thing. And I was like, he'll fall once. I've told him to get down. And then when he cries, it's because mummy's told you that's what happens.
And I think that's important that you're repeatedly saying, mummy did tell you not to do that. You decided to ignore me and that's the consequence.
Mm.
And then there needs to be a line of discipline. So I've told you this three times and you've not listened three times. And each time there's been an accident. What we're going to do now is there's going to be some sort of consequence from mummy to you if you don't listen to me in future. So I'll take away your phone or you won't get the sweeties on a Friday like you normally do. And you have to stick to it. Because one of the things that I see with parents is that they say things and they don't follow it through. So there's no respect. And then they lose their temper. So then the child is fearful. But they haven't done the work on building the boundaries with the child. I mean, reward charts, people say they don't work. Well, they only don't work because you're not
consistent.
If you're consistent with anything, the message has to be consistent because remember, they are children. They don't have the logic. They don't have the analysis. They cannot organise or plan themselves. You have to do that consistently for them. That's how the brain wires. So I always say repetition is recognition and neurons that fire together wire together. So essentially, you're going to create your sat-nav or the sat-nav for your child, the direction you want them to go in, the way you want them to behave, the way you want them to feel, the confidence you want them to have by consistency and repetition. So the neurons and nerve cells, they will link together through a synapse. But what happens is the more your brain hears the same information, the more they become magnetic towards each other. And eventually a synapse form, you've got a pathway. So it's really important in terms of neuroplasticity that we use consistent messaging with our children. Don't get frustrated with them when they don't do what you say, when you don't tell them enough in a consistent way and then blow up at them and now they're scared because now there's no respect, only fear. And that leads to emotional disorder and all sorts of things later on in life for them.
It was really important what you said then as well, though, with the following through of consequence.
Yeah.
So I think we all live in a day and age where we just want less noise, less whinging. Yes. It's really easy to throw children an iPad or something like that.
And that's on the parent, not on the child. But we are at the point now, which is dangerous, and I hope there's going to be some sort of turnaround soon, where, I mean, my daughter's 17. I remember standing in the park probably 13 years ago while I was pushing her on the swing. And even then I looked around and I would say 50% of the mums were on their phones. And that's over a decade ago. And I can't imagine what it looks like in the park now. I mean, the need for you to engage with your child, they need to see you mirroring back at them. They need to see your face enjoying the experience with them. If you've got one hand looking down because you've got your phone in it and you're pushing with the other and you're not engaging with your child, they are not building up the mirroring with the parent. Oh. So important. So when we're looking at our phones or when we're busy talking to our friends, looking over there while the child's over there, the child is no longer getting the attention. And I don't mean attention for no reason. I mean bonding that they need to have for their brains to develop healthily. Not only that, but they are also being told, oh, just go on the iPad, just go on your phone. And this is hours of the day that they're looking down and not looking up and not looking around and not looking at you and you're not looking at them. That changes the way the brain develops.
And what's the consequences of that?
Well, essentially, people become more and more in their own worlds. They become more and more isolated, even when they're surrounded by people. You only have to, I was on the train earlier. You only have to go on the train and see how many people are actually looking out of the window now. Everybody's doing this. So you're not communicating anymore. That sense of community and connection is just dissolving and disappearing. Without community and connection, we're no longer a society. So think about the real long-term consequences of that. What is the point? You know, you may as well be a lone wolf in the woods just hunting and surviving that way because, quite frankly, it's probably healthier for you because you're getting more fresh air. Mm. You know, it's losing that sense of touch with other human beings, which I think is very detrimental. Depression, anxiety, isolation, and then all the sort of neurodiverse labels that we're now hearing about.
Do you follow Johan Harry?
No.
Really interesting guy, you'll love him. But he talks about the cure to addiction is community.
Yeah.
And we think, oh, straight away, like, oh, it's just the alcohol. But the alcohol is the mask, right?
Yes.
And what sits at its core, every single one of us, you know, we used to grow up in indigenous tribes.
Yeah,
we
would
be a community. Yeah. We would be together.
Yeah.
And we, like you said, we are so isolated right now.
Even though there's people everywhere. In fact, there's too many people now. You see, we haven't got enough space anymore because we've got so many people now in a tiny little space, Great Britain, I mean, that, you know, we're surrounded by other people all the time, but nobody's connected. It's such a disconnected time, more and more people than ever before, yet we are so disconnected. But, you know, I have to caveat this with, I wouldn't have met you if it wasn't for, technology. Yeah. And there's so many good things about it. If you use it in the right way, and you've got a really positive attitude to what you want to get out of it. I want to get a feeling of community.
Right.
I want to feel connected to people that I don't know yet, because that's how I'll meet you in person. You know, so you can use it in that way. But if you're literally just scrolling and looking at silly TikTok videos, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that sometimes, but if you're addicted to that because of the dopamine thing, you know, you're sort of swiping every 3 to 4 seconds, that there's nothing positive about that for your brain. Absolutely nothing. You've got no attention span anymore. You're not really learning anything. And all you're doing is weakening the dopamine receptors in the brain. So now you want more and more and more. Where does it end?
Well, I would love to talk to you about the dopamine receptors. I just interviewed somebody really, like a professional around the whole porn thing. And they were saying, if you have a porn addiction, I think it's like you're 93% more likely to have another kind of addiction because of the way it rewires your brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Social media, gambling, substance.
Yeah, it's all the
same.
So
I'm wondering, if you then have a social media addiction, does it make you more likely for gambling?
Yes.
Okay. So we're all going to end up with a group of like huge addicts, right? Yeah. We're creating levels of dopamine, artificial dopamine, right? Yeah. Now, how can we start to undo that programming? Because I would say all of us probably sit on social media too long or getting on the periphery of having some kind of addiction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a complex question really, but I'll try and break it down as best as can. If you overuse anything, even your muscles, they get sore, you get injured, right? So I had a knee injury, which meant I had to take a whole year off the gym because I kept ignoring the signals in my knee and I kept getting lots of inflammation, lots of swelling. It was a problem. And, you know, I kind of thought, right, the only way to reset this is to have complete rest. Don't do anything. Bare minimum. Your body is crying out for rest. It's exactly the same with your dopamine receptors. If you overuse them, they get tired, they get lazy, and they need more stimulation. So what starts off, let's use Pornhub.
Yep.
What starts off as a little kind of intrigue, oh, I've watched that. That's quite titillating. I need a little bit more of that. That's not doing it for me anymore. I need to up my game. And eventually you're having to watch porn that you would never have thought you were going to watch 5 years ago.
Well, this is how they were saying paedophiles don't turn up, wake up in the morning saying, no, I want to search paedophilic images. Yeah. What happens in increments? It gets darker and more extreme because the brain requires more dopamine to hit that barrier.
Exactly. Now you think you've got a 13-year-old boy that's got an 18-year-old brother. And the 18-year-old brother is looking at porn and he's looking at things like bestiality, which is, for those that don't know, you know, sex with animals or sexual behaviour with animals. They're looking at things like women masturbating a horse, right? Because they think it's funny. That 13-year-old boy sees that and has a physiological reaction to that. Maybe he is turned on by it. Whatever reason, then what's he then going to look at to get that kick again? So what we end up getting is young boys that are getting access to, I mean, I've worked with young kids where the parents have had to send me an email first because they've been watching things like getting girls fisted. That's what they start off with, right? Wow. So this is hardcore stuff. You watch that, what's next? Where does it go from there? We are seeing now in 2025 such high levels of erectile dysfunction in men, higher than ever before. And it is because they have access to pornography in a way that they've never had before. So, of course, they're not getting turned on. When I was a kid, you literally, I mean, I'm 46 years old, so it's a very long time ago, but you'd literally only see porn if it was bin day and someone's dirty old magazine ended up on the street. And you'd be like, whoa, I've not seen that before. But that would be all you'd see. And then obviously boys might swap videos or DVDs or whatever. But now you can literally, it's there whenever you want it. So the brain is getting really lazy and needs more and more and more and more. Now, because dopamine is so integral in reward and motivation, I'm not motivated anymore because my dopamine's not being retained properly because the receptors are tired. So if I'm not motivated anymore, I need something to make me feel that spark of inspiration so I can get out of bed in the morning. So your day starts off scrolling. Maybe you go on the gambling site. Maybe you go on the porn site. Maybe you go on, I don't know, you go and buy something online. Now I can get out of bed. I've got that little bit of something. But it drops again because we're not retaining dopamine. So then what do? I'm bored. I'm not feeling connected to anybody. Oh, no, I'll go back to it because it's there. So again, you'll just see people getting further and further away. So the only way to do this, two ways. You either completely come away from social media and all that online behaviour, or we have to build in graded exposure. We have to build in other activities, creativity, gratitude, time for meditation. Times when you mentioned the Hoffman process where you go away for a certain amount of time, no phones, no nothing, you know, retreats where that's just not allowed. So you do have the dopamine cleansing experience and you get out into the wild, you go cold water, swimming, you spend time with people that you've not met before and getting to know them and connecting eye to eye, sitting around the bonfires. Or you simply start, like I say, creative writing, creative painting, pottery making. You start to make yourself do things you've not done before. New hobbies, things we would have done 30 years ago. You start a new hobby, knitting, crocheting. I'm not saying that's what I choose, but some people go, do you know what? I've not tried that before. I'd really like to give it a go.
And what's the idea behind that? That you're getting a healthy dopamine elsewhere or you said something there about cleansing the dopamine receptors.
Yeah, so instead of, I mean, at the moment, you know, both of us will finish here today, we'll have emails to check, we'll have things to do. So when your phone is gone, you literally are forced to look at the things. You might look around you again, you might notice the birds singing, you might notice the blue sky, you might hear some music and really hear it because you're not distracted. And I've seen people do this. You take the phone away from them, especially teenagers now, and they literally have a mental breakdown.
It's a chemical response.
It's a chemical response, yeah. So you have to let them go through that and you have to do things with them. So if you're going to take your kid's phone away, take them for a walk, you know, go and get some nice food together at the end of the walk and a coffee, have a chat, and they will enjoy it. They won't think they'll enjoy it because they're going through the withdrawal, but they'll start to enjoy it and then you bring more of that in.
Okay, so what about the parents that are listening to this that are working, they're going home, by the time they get home at 6 o'clock, they think, God, she's probably been on that phone at 7 o'clock in the morning, been on it at school, she's still on it, it's 10 o'clock at night, and unable, just because of the workload, to be as present. Like, what advice can you give to people that really, they can't take their phone off the 16-year-old because they get the bus to school or whatever? Yeah. Where can we start for that sticky middle ground where there's a need for a phone, but also a need for withdrawal for children?
This is controversial and some people won't agree with this, but I think it works every single time, is you replace that time. You have to have that conversation with your 16-year-old. First of all, you have to decide as a parent whether you're willing to do that, because a lot of parents are not willing to have the tough conversations. And if you're not, then you need to have a think about what you're actually doing and why. If you're avoiding tough conversations with your teenager, you've really got to go within yourself and question what it is that you're not capable of and why. Because that's what I'm seeing a lot of people. Well, I can't do that. I haven't got time. Haven't you? There's 24 hours in a day. I'm pretty sure you can factor in an hour a week to have a conversation with your own child. So that's one aspect. But if you are willing to do that, you have to reward them. You have to say, right, I've noticed that this thing's happening with the phone. I'm really concerned about it. This is why I'm concerned about it. You may or may not agree, and you probably won't. And I understand that, because you can't expect the child to agree with you and just go, right, I've seen you on your phone for 5 hours a day. I'm taking it off you for an hour a day. That won't work. Mm. You need to let them know that you've thought about this and then replace it with a reward. So we're going to come off the phone for an hour. And what we're going to do is once a week, we're going to go out for dinner. And when we go out for dinner, we're going to have a lovely meal. Doesn't matter, you know, I know people say we haven't got a lot of money, but that doesn't matter where you go, a lovely dinner together.
You can have sandwiches and go to the park.
Correct. It could be a picnic, but you're not going to have it for that period of time. And if we can keep this up consistently, I'm going to start rewarding you. So there'll be things to look forward to at the end of it, but I need you to work with me on this because I need to rebuild our relationship and I'm worried about your brain, you're not happy. And don't forget this, if you've got a teenage girl, this is really important, actually. Having a teenage girl myself, she's 17. Girls produce hormones in their adrenal glands as well as their ovaries. Boys only produce hormones in their testicles, okay? if the girls are stressed because they're on their phones all the time and they're not seeing daylight, you know, circadian rhythm's really important, getting outside. If they're not getting what they need for their brain and their neurotransmitter system isn't working properly and their endocrine system isn't working properly, which is the hormonal system, the cortisol is processed in the blood, goes through all of their organs. It affects their progesterone and estrogen. You'll find now more PCOS and endometriosis than ever before, because girls that aren't producing the right amount of chemicals and hormones and neurotransmitters are having more and more problems with their cycles. So when we are talking to our girls about this, we need to explain, you've been feeling really tired, your iron levels are low, your periods are not right, we need to correct that for you. These are the things we're going to do. But we don't make them feel guilty about being on their phone. That's a lot of what's going on, is that the parents are going, you're on your phone all the time, you're being moody, you're being miserable, you're ungrateful. And we're projecting all of our stress onto our children rather than having proper conversations. So there's no easy way to do this other than having the difficult conversations, but also taking ownership. I, as a parent, haven't watched this closely enough. I didn't understand the dangers of this. But I've been watching these podcasts or I've been reading these books and now I understand, here's the way we're going to do it. And I'm not going to punish you, that there'll be a reward at the end of it. So you're giving them that sort of, you know how we used to do
protocol.
We used to do housework and get pocket money for it. It's a similar sort of idea, because the reward needs to be in the distance. Think about how healthy dopamine works. We produce more dopamine in the pursuit of something than when we actually get it. You know, when you get a takeaway and you really can't wait for the takeaway, and then when it arrives, the dopamine levels drop. It's in pursuit of it that we are more excited. We get more pleasure. We get more reward. So actually, in the pursuit of getting the reward and coming off the phone and going out for the food, that's where they'll get their dopamine levels back up. But it will be consistent and it takes time to rewire.
That's so interesting you said that. Like, even when it's come to me doing live events or some of my biggest podcasts, I've been like, in the weeks leading up to, like, oh my god, it's happening. And when it's happening, it's never as fun as the lead up. Why?
Well, because if you think about the primitive side of this, the hunter and the gatherer, but we'll talk about the hunter, they needed sometimes to be hunting for a week before they caught anything. If we weren't getting the dopamine, the little shots of dopamine on the way, on the journey to catching the hunt, we just give up and we wouldn't
have
survive. We'd have a sleep and we'd never get the food. So we would then die.
Right. Okay.
So dopamine is motivation to survive.
Okay.
If you think about self-harm cutting.
Yeah.
One of the things that's very addictive about cutting is that the person that's doing it bleeds. When we bleed, we get dopamine because we're now going to seek survival. So we're on the journey of finding a place to survive when there's blood on a primitive level. Obviously, we're not thinking that in the modern day, but the brain goes, ah, blood, that means we need to find a place to survive or to seek safety. So we get dopamine to get us to move and find that safety.
I am so excited to show you my outfit today. I switched it up with Never Fully Dressed. If you are looking for fashion that makes you feel amazing, Never Fully Dressed has you covered. Bringing it back to, guys, I feel like this is such an important topic. We were going to do a whole nother episode on it, but I just feel like this is where we're going with it.
Yeah.
Unless you've been living under a rock and not watched the Adolescence Programme.
Oh my God, yeah.
Which is something I've always innately, as a parent, Ella, felt like children are living two worlds.
Yeah.
And I would think that I am emotionally intelligent enough, especially in my age group, to understand that online isn't reality.
Yeah.
I would say I'm emotionally intelligent enough to know that people are only posting their highlights.
Yes.
You know, I have come to realise, and especially being in this space, lots of it is bollocks. None of it's
God,
real.
Yeah.
Like, especially. And I feel there are people who are probably in my similar age group and situations, they're like, oh, this is what's happening in the world. And I think we're giving these false illusions of reality. But for me, watching the generations beneath me and beneath that grow up, I am just flapping my wings in a state of concern, because we are so connected, yet we are so disconnected.
I don't think we've ever been more disconnected. I really don't. I mean, I said to you earlier, like, if it wasn't for technology, I wouldn't meet people like you and I wouldn't have a podcast and I wouldn't have the business that I've got, you know, and I wouldn't be able to reach as many people as I can, which has always been a huge goal of mine, to be able to educate a wide audience, because I think that's one of the things that wasn't available to me when I needed it when I was younger, and I'm sure you'd say the same. Whatever we go through as children, the resources just weren't available when we were growing up. And, you know, we kind of had to work it out on our own.
Is that a bad thing,
though? No, because...
Because I remember, like, I grew up as a child of an alcoholic, and I speak about this on here, and not in too much detail, but I remember being, like, 13, 14, and being like, I need help or something. Like, I'd have a parent in the other room that was, like, unconscious, and it was just me in the house, and I would type, literally, like, what do I do, and try and find forums, and that wasn't there. So I feel like there's this fine line between I've figured my life out, but how much kinder could my life have been as a child and addict being supported?
Mm.
But in the same breath, I don't think you can ever look back with regret, because I think everything brought you somewhere. And I'm on two sides of the fence. Is it we're meant to figure it out?
We
but
are.
Then how capable are children to figure it out? And also how much of the information they're being fed is real?
So there's two things that I want to say here. So we won't talk about it in massive detail, but I grew up in a household of sexual abuse. So it was my dad, he went to prison, he came back into the house after he'd finished in prison, because my mum and dad stayed together. They're still together now. So I'm 46. That's important for time reference. When I when my dad was arrested for what he did, I was 11 years old. 11 years old was 35 years ago.
Did he rape you?
It was serious sexual assault. So not with... rape is when you're using genitals.
So what's the difference?
So insertion of things or body parts other than penis.
So like fingers?
Yes.
That would be...
That falls into serious sexual assault, not full
rape. So how
was
he found out what he was doing?
I told. So I'd been writing in a journal that was shared in a class between me and a friend. Someone snatched the journal out of his hand. It went, as you can imagine, the whole class knew about it, because I think they thought it was a love letter. So the whole class knew about it. So then it was taken out of my hands. That was never my intention for him to be arrested. Children don't think that far ahead. I was 11. So it was more a case of I need someone to know about this, because it was a lot to carry. And I just needed that outlet.
Release.
Yeah, release. But the point being is that when he was arrested and went to prison, because he admitted it, so I didn't have to go through court with it or anything. But when he went to prison, I saw a social worker three times. Later on, because I was self-harming and, you know, I was not functioning very well at that point, because my mum was staying with my dad, so I knew he was going to come back home.
This is wild. We're getting back shit into this crazy.
I know, we're going from story. One thing to
no,
another.
But we're
going to
jump into that again.
We'll link it in. So obviously he was able to come back home about 4 years later, I think. And during that time, I was raped by a 20-year-old when I was 13, because I ended up being outside of the house and I was hanging around with much older people. I was drinking. I was doing all those things that a dysfunctional teenager would do. My mum kept saying, I'm going to put you into care. So I just didn't want to be there, you know. And the long and short of it was there was no help. There were no books. To get a book on a subject of sexual abuse, you'd have to go to the library, and you'd have to have the emotional balance to know that you want to go to the library to research sexual abuse in children. I mean, it wasn't in my mind to do that. The school weren't really involved. They just kind of left you to it then. And like I said, 30 years ago, he was able to walk out of prison and walk back into the home. No one stopped it happening. So again, when he got back home, he was violent.
Did he abuse you again?
Yeah, he was violent. Not sexually, but he was physically violent. So, you know, years and years of abuse, but no services really. There was no books, no internet. I didn't even have the internet until I was 22. So there was none of this. So I'm saying that for a reason, really, because there is a point of having lots of resources and having people and voices that are saying what they've been through, because you'll never feel alone. I thought I was the only one. Because, of course, back then, no one spoke about it.
Of course.
So I thought I was the only one. I thought I was I was mentally unwell, but I thought I was mad. I thought I was a psychopath. My mum had told me I was the problem. I didn't have a frame of reference. So I think information's crucial. And that's why, again, I was saying I'm really grateful to have a wider audience and to be able to reach people and to be able to speak about these things. But if you are a child who has access to anything and everything at any time of day, and even if you've got strong parental controls on your children's devices, their friends don't always. So when they're at school or when they're hanging out, and let's forget, there's no community centres anymore. There's nowhere for them to go. So when they are outside, when they're seeing their friends, you don't know what they're doing. And you can't stop them having that contact with the outside world. But even if you've got the strongest parental controls within your home, they have friends that don't. So they will see things that they cannot process and understand. And the more they see it, the more it's wired in. The more it's wired in, the more normal it becomes. So whether we're talking about someone stabbing someone to death, whether we're talking about porn, whether we're talking about gambling, whether we're talking about online shopping, we are giving these children free rein to build addictions because they don't know what's happening to their brain. So they don't think it. They haven't got long-term thinking yet. They can't do that until this part, the prefrontal cortex, is developed at 25. So we are seeing an epidemic of addiction, isolation, depression, anxiety, neurodiversity, and it is all trauma-focused. It was all trauma-based.
Hi, everybody. Me here. I hope you're enjoying the episode. Listen, I hate doing this, but subscribers matter so much to us in the show, so we can bring you all the guests that we need. So please don't forget to like and subscribe. And if you're having a good old time listening to the episode, please share it with your friends. Let's go back to the episode. I know we spoke about it off air, but I have a real problem with the whole ADHD thing,
yeah,
because every man and their dog has now got ADHD, which for me means no one's got ADHD now,
yeah,
right? Because I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was 12, but I was living in an environment that was unsafe. You know, we look back and what is ADHD? It's the inability to sit still, to sit with ourselves, incessant thoughts, those kind of things. And as a 12-year-old that's going home to a dangerous environment with no caregiver and to fend for yourself, that's an automatic trauma response.
Yeah.
And another thing I think we're forgetting is like, oh, it just annoys me so much. Like everywhere I go, if I meet, are they called Gen Zens?
Yeah.
They're like, oh, no.
X, Gen X.
Okay, so I was talking to one and she said, oh, yeah, no, because I don't sleep well. I've got my ADHD. I won't say where I was. And because we were talking about sleep. And I said, oh, do you turn your phone off before you go to bed? No, I love TikTok. I literally watch it and go off. So I was like, okay. But what we're forgetting is these devices are programmed for a short attention span.
Yeah.
So I'm not discrediting that people may be showing ADHD symptoms, right? But we are being programmed to have a three seconds of attention span. We've got less of attention span than a goldfish at the moment.
Yeah.
Like it is wild. I think we are given so much data. It's the equivalent of watching 16 movies back to back a day. I think it's 74 gigs of data we are downloading. So it's no wonder that the generations coming underneath us are showing qualities of ADHD, right?
Yeah.
So that is a true thing because we are being wired by this device.
Yeah.
Where you and I were being wired by the world,
yeah,
that was giving us a trauma response that had ADHD symptoms.
Yeah.
They're being wired
by devices.
A phone.
Yeah.
And we're all ending up in this level of chaos, like you see, an epidemic of neurodiversity.
Yeah, yeah. And the truth is, this is the truth. I would say this to anyone when we're talking about neurodiversity, and this is my belief, and there may be some clinicians that strongly disagree, and that's absolutely fine, but this is my belief. And I've worked as a psychotherapist with a trauma-focused approach for 20 years. So, and I've also, as I've explained, come from a home of trauma, and I've also got a diagnosis of ADHD. So I'm going to speak on this from a perspective of anecdotal evidence over the last 20 years, and also reading lots of research papers and being a professional. I believe that all neurodiversity is trauma. And some people would say, okay, well, how could that be? Because we're looking at vaccinations. My son wasn't autistic until he had this vaccination, then he became very autistic. And I would say this, when we look at the field of epigenetics, now epigenetics, for those that have not heard of it before, is where we are carrying a genetic expression handed down through generations before us in our family lineage, okay? So 2013, there was a study done with Holocaust survivors and their grandchildren had higher incidence of anxiety, stress and depressive disorders. Obviously, their grandparents have been through quite a lot of trauma. We saw also with the starvation of the Holocaust survivors that their grandchildren had higher levels of obesity because the genetic expression changed to hold on to fat more because of the starvation in their grandparents. So all of these epigenetic studies that are there are based on grandparents and grandchildren so far. So when we look at those studies and then we look at neurodiversity now, My grandparents were World War II. Then there was World War I before them. And then, of course, there was all sorts of plagues and famines and wars before that. So we see that the genetic expression changes through the generations. So essentially, think of your genetic expression as a code that is ready to be switched on or lay dormant. So if then you bring your child into a world where there's vaccinations we don't fully understand, where they're coming into homes where there's lots of trauma, lots of things, like I said earlier, we're not giving our children as much attention as they should have, so they're getting neglected more. They might be coming into abusive homes. They might be coming into a home of an addict, all these sorts of things. What happens is it switches the code on for a lot of these disorders, but also the pregnancy itself. You know, as the fetus is developing, if the mother is highly stressed, which we live in a much more stressful world now, where there's not a lot of connection and community, where the mother's on the phone, where she's working 10 hours a day, where there's not a lot of money because of the cost of living, there's not a lot of space or good living conditions because of the way the political situation is at the minute, the child is growing in the fetus is growing in a stressful environment. Then they come into a stressful environment, so all the codes are being switched on. And it's all trauma focused, it's all stress focused, and it's all epigenetics.
So what is the answer?
The answer is we have to change the way we do things. And you have to do that from the perspective of the individual first and then blend that into the collective. We know that the collective is an issue. We know that the culture is an issue at the minute. We know that community is an issue at the minute. We know that school systems are an issue at the minute. We can't change any of that. But it goes back to those conversations that you have within your home. It goes back to chatting to your neighbours. It goes back to being willing to, even if it feels so hard. You know, you start talking to someone on social media or you get connected through someone that you know, make that leap. Go and meet that person. You know, have an in-person experience with people, because more and more people are on their Zoom, they're on their social media, they're watching lives, they're listening to podcasts. So many people aren't even going out anymore. You know, the pubs have all become pub restaurants. We've lost those community hubs. So you've got to force yourself to get out of the house, to have the difficult conversations within your family, to make new friends, to try new things, to start new hobbies, to get outside more. I know it sounds really simple, but it's the simple things that work. We overcomplicate it.
But I think as well, the schools have a lot to be accountable for.
The system is screwed.
They should be like, it's really hard because I'm like, no phones, but I get, do you remember you said like the Nokia 3310
yes.
card? Like, can't we go back to that? So yes, we all agree a phone is needed, but we got to school and back alive.
Yeah. And I know people go, it was so much safer then. It wasn't. I mean, we've just both opened up about our own experiences at home. Don't forget, I was sexually abused in my home. So, you know, I've been more concerned about what goes on behind closed doors than I am about what goes on in the street. Don't get me wrong. I know there's gangs out there and I know that there's lots of knife crime and lots of sort of county line stuff going on. I'm fully aware of that. So, yes, you have got to be involved in your child's life. Yes, you do need to go and pick them up and drop them off or at least travel with them on public transport. You've actually got to be a parent. And so yes, the systems are screwed with the schools and I'll come on to that in a minute. But parenting has been lost as well. People don't know how to be parents, you know, and that's because guess what? Their parents, like ours, may well have been very dysfunctional and they haven't recovered from their own traumas. This is where the space of community is so important. Having, you know, 30 years ago, women would work part time. I'm not saying this is how I work very full time too much. Because I am flawed as well as, you know, a psychotherapist. I do have some bad habits myself. But, you know, women would sit around the kitchen table together. The men would go out to work and they'd talk and they'd share their stories and they'd console each other and they'd be there for each other. Well, when I had my daughter, all of my friends were at work because I had mine at 29, which is actually quite young now. But, you know, a lot of my friends had their kids at 19, 20, 21. They were back at work. So I was on my own. And I felt very isolated. Luckily, it was before the phone issue was such a big issue. But it's not the same as it was before.
Well, you forget like when women, and I think the Indian community does it great. When a woman gives birth, they all come round.
They rally
all
around.
Help. They bring the food. They bring everything. And I remember feeling so isolated and lonely when I had a son as well, because of the impact of social media. I'm like, well, everyone else looks like they've got their shit together. So-and-so's just said their baby's already sleeping. And I was like, oh my gosh, this, that. And you go over your innate compass of like what you know is right. So I would then end up following some woman on there that's telling me how my child should sleep.
Yeah.
When really there's this undeniable powerful bond between mother and son.
Intuition.
I feel like we've got no intuition anymore. Yeah. We live in a world where we've been constantly sold and told how we should think, how we should act, who we should vote for. We don't trust ourselves anymore.
We don't.
And we don't trust the fact that, you know, you and I will have different dreams, Ella. Like, we'll both want different things. And that dream was put in your heart for a reason. And for so long, I used to yearn when I was younger. I was like, I want to be a TV presenter, and then I want to do this charity work, and I want to do that. And I could never see how they would all come together. And I used to think, oh, I can't do that now. Like, I'm too old. And what we forget is that was planted in you as an order to go and fulfill it, to go and do it. But kids are being reprogrammed on these devices where I worry that their social media is, I don't even want to say second home, but for a lot of them, I feel like it could be their first home.
Yeah.
And this act of comparison, right? Because they're watching people who are on like year five, and they're on day zero. And that gap, right, can freeze you from moving. It nearly freezed me as like an emotionally intelligent as well, older woman, I was looking at people in this space and like, I'm never going to get there. And there has this, it wires your brain, doesn't it? It's almost like not to try.
Yeah, it does.
Because it freezes you.
Yeah.
And then I almost feel like then you have the other side of the coin where they have, and I'd love to talk about this, no concept of time. Right.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
We have no concept of time, me included. And it's not until you really understand that things take time.
Patience.
Even my son is like, why is the Amazon not being here today, Mum? Yeah. And everything is instant gratification. And I think that stops children from doing something. I mean, I had a lady on here. She's amazing. Oh, we're wearing her clothes, actually. Never fully dressed. We love her. And she, look at little glammy.
Love it.
She came on and she was talking about the people within her company, and they were saying that after a year, some of the young girls, you know, really like, I would imagine my career would have gone further. She's like, you have no idea. Mm. Like, it takes years to build up to get to the next level.
Of course it does.
Yeah, and like, people used to say to her, isn't it great? You've just popped up. So I've been on market stalls for 14 years.
That's the funny thing.
14 years. It's like Joe Rogan. He's been doing a show, I think it's something like almost 10 years.
And the, do you know the thing I like about Joe Rogan, although his episodes are exceptionally long, the thing I love about Joe Rogan is he doesn't care. He's doing what he wants, the way he wants to do it. Doesn't matter what the algorithm says. I mean, obviously Joe Rogan can do what he wants, but he never, ever diverted from his own style. And he's just kept it the same the whole time. He hasn't gone, oh, actually, that person's doing that. I need to change this up. And it's one of the things, and you know as well, when you do a podcast, and I've been doing mine for a couple of years, it's so tempting to look at other people and go, oh, they've got that much better than me. I need to change that.
Yeah.
And actually, I just think if you just be yourself.
Well, interestingly, when I started, I met somebody who was like a professional in the space. I think they wanted to represent me. And they said, right, so but what we need to do is we need to start having some kind of order to this, and people need to know, are you listening to a business podcast? Are you listening to a motivational? You know, what is it? So that every week they're getting like, they know what they're signing up for and it's a similar theme. I'm like, no.
No, because that's boring.
I want to talk to people. I want to talk to an underage male escort.
Yeah.
I want to talk to other people. I want to talk to CEOs. I want to talk to inspiring people.
Yeah.
I want to, Bonnie Blue, I was, what the hell? What the fuck are you doing, love?
Yeah.
Also, what is your driving force in getting there? If I speak to the same people, I'm not going to learn anything new.
No.
And that was a huge thing for me, because having that imposter syndrome starting off, I almost was like, okay, then I need to find this group of just like really inspiring guests.
You'd be bored in 5 minutes. And if you're bored, they're not going to want to sit and talk to you anyway. Mm. Variety is the spice of life. Mm. And very similar, mine's the new mind. And the new mind means anyone and anything that is now. Because now is new to what it was yesterday. So the new mind is just about anything and everything. It's a very, very similar concept, because I'm curious and I get excited by people and what they've done and where they're going and what they believe, even if I don't agree. And that's the thing that I really enjoy about the podcast space in general, is that I watch a lot of podcasts where, you know, 50-50. I don't agree with 50% of what I hear, and I do agree with the other 50%. But it allows me, if I can stand back and zoom out, which I do, and be introspective and reflective, it allows me to form my own opinion. And it's okay that my own opinion might be different to yours, Brogan, because I love you anyway.
Yeah.
We could have completely different opinions on some things, but I think you're awesome. And so what I think we have lost, and what used to be the case in the working men's clubs and the pubs and community clubs and youth clubs, is that you would have conversations with people where you disagreed and you'd still be friends. Whereas now online, if you disagree with someone, they'll call you every name under the bloody sun. Yeah.
Well, we're living in a world that's very polarising. So, you know, you're either vaxxed or not vaxxed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, who are you voting? Labour, Conservative. There's no in between. And this was a huge thing for me, especially when I, you know, I spoke about it in my live event, is that there is beauty in diversity.
Yes.
And being in this space, like we've spoken about before, I can speak to people. It doesn't mean I represent their views. No. I had Lily Phillips on here last week.
Yes,
I know. And then I had Lila Micklewaite, the lady that's brought down Pornhub.
Yeah.
So we live in a world where we really want to, like, label people.
Yeah.
And it's about having the ability to have those conversations. But it worries me, the types of, like, Bonnie Blue and Lily Phillips, they are glamorising a lifestyle to young girls.
It goes back to what we were saying about what's available on your phone and how accessible what they're doing is. I mean, I find, for boys and girls, what does that say? They're going to be hearing about these two ladies. And this is no disrespect to them, because I don't know enough about their histories to be able to form an opinion. But it makes me very, very sad that they are leading the way for a group of girls and boys that are coming up that are going to be severely traumatised. Both, and it's not just the girls that will be traumatised by this level of porn and this type of sex. It's the boys as well. It will lead to erectile dysfunction, which will be very difficult for them later on. You know, when they reach their 30s and their 40s and they're unable to maintain an erection because they've been exposed to so much gratuitous porn, it is going to affect them. It's going to affect their self-esteem. It's going to affect their relationships. And it's going to lead to more and more problems with relationship breakdown, society breakdown. This is not something that's just shocking and gratuitous. This is something that is breaking society down. And it's affecting our brains in a way that is essentially damaging us. You know, we talk about brain damage as though it's a physical response. Brain damage is emotional, it's psychological, and you can repair it. This is the type of work I do, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of consistency. The type of therapy I do is not just about you talking and me listening. It's about fixing these problems that we're talking about, because I came from such a heavy trauma background. I was so curious about how we could fix trauma and how we could overcome that as an emotional brain damage. And that's what's going to happen to society at large.
And that's what we're seeing as well, is that the highest level of virgins, because we're getting sexual intimacy with a computer. So people aren't going out and hunter-gathering, seeking, you know, relationships in order to have sexual gratification. They're just watching it online.
Let me tell you what I saw the other day, and it shocked me. Although I laughed, it also shocked me. I laughed and then thought about it. I thought, that's not funny at all. It's actually quite scary. I was on Facebook, which I'm very rarely on, and there was an advert that came up. God knows why my algorithm picked this, by the way, for an AI boyfriend. So basically...
Stop.
No, I swear to God. Why me? I don't know, because I definitely didn't put that out into the universe. But... The thing was, it was a guy wearing a fireman's outfit of all things, walking through flames, top off, muscles everywhere. And basically, you could sign up and subscribe and you get to pick a boyfriend. And obviously, the robot, by the way, will chat to you and you'll have a relationship with this AI man. And I'm sure they do the girlfriend as well. Wow. So you'll literally have a boyfriend that doesn't exist. And that is already out there now.
Hi, guys. I'm Brogan from Getting There, the podcast. And I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Guys, I am completely obsessed with London Nootropics. They use the top quality aptogens. And I know I'm fueling myself with the good stuff. It helps me feel alive and like the lights are turned on without the jitters. Honestly, I'm obsessed. Use code GETTINGTHERE for 20% off. Let me know what you think.
And I think going back to what we're saying as well, I feel like we're that intuition, intimacy, connection. For me, they're the main things that make us human.
Yeah.
Children are having an inability to sit with themselves. And I don't, like, guys, I don't mean to sit, even mean that on a spiritual level, but I also do, to sit still and think with themselves and process their own thoughts.
Yeah.
How do we overcome that then?
I think one of the things that we've got to do is teach them what that means and teach them how that feels, because don't forget, what happens in the brain also happens in the body. So think about the cellular system, and I won't overcomplicate this because most people won't care about the different types of cells, but just think about the cellular system as little light bulbs within the nervous system, and your mapping is based on what you've felt before. So, for example, if you grew up in a household that was very traumatic, you will have the fear response. I mentioned the amygdala earlier. Imagine the amygdala is a dial. So instead of it just being like, it looks a bit like an acorn, but imagine that it's a dial. And it should be around 3 to 4. So you've got some awareness of danger. You know, if you're walking home late at night and you hear footsteps behind you, your amygdala will alert you that there's danger, you know. But for someone that grows up in a very traumatic household, and that could be neglect, it could be physical abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, what happens is their amygdala is turned all the way up to 10. So they're now in danger zone all of the time. So if that's the case, the messages have been sent and the chemicals and the hormones from the brain into the nervous system to get you to be ready to fight, flight or freeze. And there's other fawning and all the other things. Now, if that happens over and over again, not only are we wiring this into the brain, I'm not safe, I'm not enough, or I'm too much, or whatever the message is, but it's also being mapped cellularly in the body.
Wow.
So your body will now be prepared before you've had a chance to think. So when it comes to sitting with yourself, if you're a child that's never had to sit, have a conversation, think, reflect, do some creative writing or some painting or some arts and crafts because your parents or your school or whatever hasn't provided you with that, you actually don't have the mapping to be able to do it. So it's not only just a thought, it's also a feeling.
I think there's going to be a lot of kids coming through who have not done that, you know.
They're just...
I watch my mates' kids, they all just chuck them an iPad. And I'm not... This isn't a judgmental space.
No, it's just the way it goes. That's the way it is. So they're not able to sit with themselves. It takes teaching, it takes practice, it takes training. So you can't get a child that's always been given an iPad from the age of 3, who's now 7, to want to sit and do nothing. That's just not going to happen. You have to do it in small increments. So let's for 5 minutes do a funny dance in the living room, you know, and let's have a laugh. And then we move from doing a funny dance to let's for 5 minutes sit down and do some creative writing. Tell me a funny story about what happened at school this week. So the more you do those little 5 minute tasks with them, and then you do 3 or 4 5 minute tasks a day, get them to move their body, get them to do something creative, get them to do something that they're grateful for, get them a gratitude jar, whatever it is, then you make that time a little bit longer. And after they've done the dancing or the writing or the drawing or whatever it is, you say, right, let's just sit and think about what we've done and then we'll talk about it. Have a look at what you've written. And it's just really just tiny, tiny little habits that you build into their day until eventually they can sit with a book and read for half an hour. But it takes time and consistency.
Well,
it goes back to
time?
That. Say that again.
How long? There were people thinking, like, how long do I give this a go before I give up?
Well, from a brain-based perspective,
yes,
it takes about 21 days to create a habit, and it takes about 90 days, so let's say 90 repetitions, consistent repetitions, for it to become part of the wiring in the brain. Continue that for maybe, let's say, another 90 days. It's now an autonomic system response.
Yeah.
So really, 21 days create the habit within your child, 90 repetitions, can't say the word now, repetitions, create a sort of more learnt behaviour, and another 90 days or 90 repetitions after that for an autonomic response. So it's not that long.
Well, a good 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've got to be consistent. And I think it's what I always say to people is you've got to ask yourself why you're doing it. Don't just do it because you've been listening to this podcast and think, right, Brogan said or Ella said. Do it because you want to. What do you want for your life? What do you want for your family? What's important to you? Because if you can work out why you're doing it. Now, I would say with my daughter that the drive was always, I just wanted to have a good relationship with her. And I didn't ever want her to look back. I mean, don't get me wrong, I am flawed as a human and I haven't been a perfect parent. And I'm sure there's things that she could say that would be, you know, I would be ashamed of, because that's just what being a parent is about. But what I would like to think is that I've instilled enough moral, ethical values. We did a lot of stuff outside. We did a lot of arts and crafts. You know, in those early years, I spent a lot of time with her, and I think I embedded some really good habits. And I look at her now, and she's really sort of self-starting. She's motivated by what she wants in life. She doesn't know exactly what she wants.
There's that beauty of being young.
Yeah, she's obviously going to discover that as she goes along, but she has got that discipline. Yes, she sits on her phone too much, but so do I. Yeah. You know, I'm saying all of this as a person that still needs to, you know, practice what I preach. I would say I'm 50% of the way there, and I'm much better than I was a couple of years ago with all this stuff. But
it's hard when your work's online too, isn't it?
Yeah, because I do have to use technology. Yeah. You know, I am online as well as in person. I am, you know, I have got a couple of social media accounts that I've got to look after. I do have to deal with emails.
Do you think social media should be banned for children under 16? They're trying to pass it at the moment, aren't
they? I do. I think that would, I really think that would make a huge, huge difference. I think the way that girls compare and despair. I was thinking about this just the other day, actually, about makeup, right? When I was growing up, you go to Superdrug on a Saturday if you had some pocket money and you buy some Rimmel lipstick or something.
Or the mousse.
Do
you remember the mousse? The mousse you got out of your lips as well.
Absolutely. It was all good stuff. But you'd only have a lipstick and an eyeliner, and that'd be about them. And you'd be lucky to have a mascara. These days, these girls take about 4 hours. I'm not joking, to get ready in the morning to go to school, to do contouring, to do, I don't know the terms, because I've never looked into it. But me, it takes about 10 minutes to do my makeup in the morning. I've got a good routine. I know girls that I'm working with, you know, young girls that are getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, taking 2 hours to get ready.
No, stop.
I'm not joking. So that they can go to school.
And do you think that is because of social media? Yep. It's affecting their confidence? Yep.
Because they're looking at girls who look perfect, and we know that filters will be applied. But even though they know that, don't forget the brain responds from the emotional place first. So they have an emotional response to what they see. 95% of our brain-body system is subconscious. Only 5% is subconscious. So they have an emotional response to what they see, and they can only use 5% of their conscious thinking to analyse that. And don't forget the prefrontal, the bit that does CEO, executive function, isn't fully developed till 25. So they can't analyse it, logicalise it, and organise it the way we can as adults. So they have the emotional response, and then they want to look like that girl because they feel ugly, they don't feel like they're enough, they feel like they've got body dysmorphia. They're all kind of dealing with neurodiversity symptoms because the world is the way it is, the technology in the home and yada 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 society. So yeah, 2 hours to get ready to go to school.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think social media is wrecking boys and girls' confidence as
it
well.
Is.
Because, you know, it's the oldest saying, you know, comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah. And the boys are very narcissistic now. I'm not saying they're narcissists. Mm-hmm. I'll be very clear, they're narcissistic because they are looking at certain people online. And they're seeing the shorts, not the context. Okay, so you talk about the 3 second thing.
Yeah.
We know that shorts are like 30 seconds. So if a boy watches a short of a certain character talking in a certain way, that's the information he's got. He's not seeking out the long form. He's not seeking out context. He doesn't care about analysing and logicalising and organising that. He is then acting, which is what all children do. They're driven by pleasure and they're masking and acting out. They're mimicking others and their behaviour is quite narcissistic. They're watching loads of porn. So they have sex with a girl, say that they're both 14.
Fuck.
And they want something else because the dopamine receptors. So everything that we've spoken about earlier in this episode.
Everything in the world is getting more extreme, 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 extreme because we're programming ourselves dopamine, 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 extreme, extreme.
Dopamine
porn,
is the issue.
Food, tech, relationships, everything. It's like boom, boom, we need
the
more, we need more.
The dopaminergic system is the current human issue. If we don't sort it out by going back to basics, back to the simple things, we are fucked.
When is the right age for someone to have social media?
I mean, I didn't even use a mobile phone until I was 19 years old. I remember someone saying, did you know you could send a text message? I was like, what the hell is that? It took me about 4 hours to work it out. And I thought, this is way too long. I'm just going to make a phone call. So I would say, I think if you think the prefrontal cortex doesn't really fully develop till mid-20s, I would say 21 is a good time to start using social media. because you can start to use it for business, you can start to use it for socializing, you can effectively. You've got enough complex thinking and freedom of thought at that age to be able to start to use it sensibly. However, that's just a dream. That's never going to happen. I just think it's an ideal age. In America, you can't buy alcohol in a bar until you're 21 for a reason, because of brain development. You know, they say if you smoke too much marijuana or any marijuana before the age of 21, you're going to affect your brain development. Social media is the same. It is another way of damaging the brain development in our young people. And the difficulty I have with this is knowing that you cannot police it. It's something that society as a whole, I think, will have to see change at a systemic level. And we know that there's too much money in it, and we know that there's too much power in it. So it's never going to change.
We're being brainwashed.
That is the word. It is literally brainwashed.
Another thing that people don't think about enough is the radiation it's giving off. That we will, in times to come, I know James laughs at me. I'm like, dude, you're electrocuting yourself. So I have like a PMF protector on the back of my phone, on all of our devices, everything. But think about it. I can FaceTime my auntie in Australia, and it's going within instances. We are sending these signals. Mm-hmm. And we forget we are a biofield
agree.
We are a field. Like, I can tell, Ella, if you walk through that door, before you say anything, oh shit, she's upset.
Yeah.
Because you are a frequency. Yeah, you are giving and emitting energy, right?
Yeah.
The phone is an energy. Yeah. Like, you must have had it before, you'd like been in your phone too long, it's tingly.
Yes.
Or you get a brain, like, oh, I've been on this phone too long. It's emitting an energy. And I think I had this lady on, Tony, and she was talking about the rise in childhood brain tumours.
Yeah.
And it's a form of radiation. What was everyone doing in COVID?
On their
phones. Kids over there, headsets, gaming.
I say to every people, do not use Bluetooth headphones. Do not use them. If you're going to use headphones, use them with a wire on. Don't use the Bluetooth ones. They frighten me. They really scare me. I don't like Bluetooth headphones at all. And also I would say to you, even if you look at Fern Cotton and Davina McCall recently, both women, I mean, Davina's in her 50s, but Fern's obviously in her 40s. Both of them have tumours. Where do they have them? One in the head, and Fern had hers here. Where do you hold your phone? No one's really speaking about.
I am. I want to do an episode on it.
Yeah, it frightens me. And I think I saw a girl yesterday. She was a client of mine. She came in and she had, and I didn't say it because we were obviously talking about her. It was a professional meeting. But she had her phone in the front pocket of her shirt.
Breast cancer.
And I was like, oh God, take it out. But you don't want to be that.
So another reason boys are becoming infertile, though.
Yeah,
because it's a radiation in their pockets.
Yes. So we're seeing more and more of these problems. And I'm not saying, look, lifestyle in general, we mentioned circadian rhythm earlier. You know, getting up when the sun is rising, getting outside, exercise, making sure that you are eating as healthily as possible within the framework of money that you have. But also being mindfully aware that these aren't just conspiracy theories talking about, you know, brain tumours and cancer with phones and radiation. There is lots and lots and lots and lots of instances that we're seeing now that are not just a coincidence. Mental health, neurodiversity, cancer.
And
they're,
I think,
that's
been driven by food as well.
Yes.
Because it's not food what kids think of food. Like, even like these healthy organic things or that they're giving the kids in the shops, rapeseed oil.
Yeah.
Like that, no one should be eating that.
No.
Sugar.
Yeah.
And we're wondering why we're seeing an increase in neurodiversity. And I think I used to think it was like one answer, like, oh my God, is it the vaccine? Is it this? But actually, we have a toxic load.
It's holistic.
In everything,
yeah,
right?
It's holistic.
In the vaccines, in our food. In our relationships,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Technically, I was made neurodiverse by having a neglectful childhood. Like,
yeah.
There are so many things that are triggering us.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're just growing a nation of addicts.
Well, we are. And when you think about addiction, and I kind of want to say this because we've used the word addiction a lot today. When we look at what addiction actually is, addiction is masking a wound. Okay. So the wound can be, you grew up in a difficult home, I grew up in a difficult home, but it could also be isolation. The wound is not feeling enough or feeling too much, and our environments are going to make us feel one or the other, and sometimes a bit of both. The addiction is an escapism from the wound. That's all it is. Mm. But also when it comes to devices, why are they escaping what's going on in their home? Either because the parents aren't giving them the time, because they need to work more than ever. I mean, I know women that are they're single mums, they're working full time, and they're still having to go to a food bank. How do they parent their child when the father may be around, but again, he works full time? Mm. You know, their families aren't close by anymore like we used to be. We used to live in villages, and everybody, like you were saying about Indian families, they've got all their families close by. They stay together. The Western way of doing things is that we go off and we don't have, I mean, I didn't have any support with my daughter at all. It was, it was her, us. So the way I got around that was, went outside, went to the, we had a park 10 minutes away. It wasn't the best area, but we went there every day. I went running with her in the pushchair every day. So she saw me exercise every day. We went out to walk the dog every day. We picked up leaves. We, you know, did arts and crafts. We did the simple things. And I'm not saying it was easy because I didn't have any money at the time either. I was building my business then. But it was something that I think I would never change. And I would never change that, because if I'd have had loads of people around me, I don't know if I'd have had as much one-to-one time. You know, that bonding. We went through a phase when she was in her early teens, which most mums and daughters do, where it felt like there was a bit of a gap. She was becoming more independent. I wasn't the cool mum anymore. She didn't want me around. And I'd probably done some things wrong by that point as well, which she was holding against me, fair enough. But now I feel like, even if we don't talk every day in depth because we're all so busy, I know we've got a good relationship. Mm. I know she knows she's loved. And I know she'll hold cellular memories, if not conscious memories, of those experiences that we had when she was younger. These kids today aren't going to have that. I'm not saying all children, because I know you're really thinking about how you raise your son.
Yeah, but still, even me, I catch myself. Like, and I was sitting there the other day, like, say you pick up from school's 3, like, so I have to leave at 2:30. Like, you can't just stop your day at 2:30.
No.
Especially when you're grafting and you want to do something. And it's,
yeah,
it's about connections and meeting people and doing this. Like, I feel like there's so much expectation on us.
Yeah, there
but
is.
But for me, it's like, whoa, like, I really have to be like, right, this has to go away.
But what I'll say to you about this is, and I use this all the time, and I ask women when they come in, more so women than men, but I do this with men as well, because women have got such a guilt complex now because we are working harder than ever before. But if you don't prioritise yourself, your child's not going to be happy anyway. A lot of people put their kids first. So they go, kids first, then work, then my husband or my partner, then my friends, then whatever is on the end, bit of me time, going to the gym or whatever. And I say to mums and fathers, put yourself first. That doesn't mean you don't love your child. That doesn't mean you neglect your child. It means that your cup is now full, or your oxygen mask is on first, and then you can feed your child quality time, not just time. If you prioritise, and this is about scheduling and planning.
That's why for me it's only started to come on the earlier I get up.
Yes.
That moment for me.
And I always think if you get up with an hour to yourself a day.
That's what I have to do.
Yeah. Then you can get certain things done. That doesn't mean you're not going to be distracted by your phone. I mean, you're a voice note because it's easier for you, aren't you? And it's the same for me. I mean, when I work in clinic, I've got usually 10 people a day back to back to back to back to back. I mean, the only, if I'm texting you, Brogan, it's because I'm doing a wee. Like, that is the truth. That's why I very rarely voice note, because you'll hear me doing a wee at the same time. But, you know, there's not a lot of time there. But when she was growing up, I was probably seeing 4 to 5 people a day. So I'd drop her off to school, pick her up. She'd see me there at the times where she needed to see me, and then I'd go to work later on in the evening. And that kind of allowed me to have it all. But I was exhausted.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing, that there is a price to pay for all of this. Trying to find a healthy balance isn't easy. That's why I say to people, don't think you can change this overnight. This is 6 months of consistent habit change for you and your family. And if you've got the intention and you know why you're doing it and you know what you're aiming for, then you'll get there.
And I think that's important, because we're always aiming, but we never know what we're aiming at. And
for me,
that's been key to working out backwards, right? So if I want that, or I want this, and I want to get there, right? What do I need to do to get there? Because we live in a world where we wake up, and from the moment we're programmed, and we're just like, it's like a game of Paddington. Yeah. We're just knocking things off and batting them off, that we don't have that moment to come back to ourselves and be like, what is my intention with this?
But the question is as well, why do you want to get there? You know, it's called getting there, but why? Why do you want to get there? And it doesn't matter whether it's because you need to prove something to yourself because you never felt enough. That's enough of a reason.
And that's probably what most of us is driving us.
Yeah. I mean, I would say
so
that...
So where's your there? I have to know.
Okay, so...
Where are you heading towards?
I think this is interesting, because I always thought it was about proving something to myself. But when I was younger and I was self-harming and I was... acting out, what people might call attention seeking, you know, the odd overdose here and there for fun. And just getting into terrible, dangerous situations all the time and leaving her and all that stuff. There was no one there for me. And I was labelled as a problematic person, and I was labelled as mad, Fruit Loop, you know, piece of shit, all these things that were said to me. And because there weren't the resources and there wasn't the information that was delivered in a way that I could really digest, there was a lot of clinical information I could have read, but I just wanted somebody that I could go to that would say, it's all right, like, this is normal within the realms of what you're going through. So I think it started off as proving something to myself, and now it's just about being somebody that other girls that have been sexually abused, especially intrafamilial sexual abuse, you know, where it's happening in your family or in your home. I wanted to be someone that could show them, look, you're going to get through this. You're going to be awesome. However ugly or unworthy or unwanted you feel right now, there are people out there that can show you a different path, and there is hope. And you can get there. You don't have to take your own life. You don't have to cut yourself. You don't have to have these horrendous relationships with boys that are going to treat you like shit just for a tiny little bit of love. There's someone there that's been there, done that, got the t-shirt, and I can show them how to get there. And it doesn't have to just be girls. It could be boys that have been sexually abused, or it can be people that just feel lost or not enough. That's the why now, because I think that then means that what happened to me and what has happened to other people like me and you, it's not for nothing anymore.
It's a purpose to your pain.
Yeah, exactly. And I always say you can turn it into power.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's easy to live in a victim mindset of this happens.
Yeah.
But until we can understand that, for me, it's really important that, like, life is happening for you.
Yes.
And you can make those decisions to turn it into something powerful. Yeah.
Well, I'm genuinely grateful for the experiences I had early on. Because I don't think I'd be as curious. I don't think I'd be as driven. I don't think I'd be as empathetic. I don't think I'd be as in love with other people, because I love people and I love life. And I think because it was very, very, very dark for a really long time, I appreciate everything now. You know, I appreciate the fact that I'm here. I appreciate the fact that there's a blue sky. I appreciate the fact that I can afford to get on a train to come here. I appreciate the fact that I've been able to build a business and use my brain. I feel like the brain's so important and it's my favourite thing about us. And I appreciate that I've got a brain that functions well.
Yeah. And you know, I appreciate this conversation. It's been so eye-opening. Like, before we started, I was thinking, you know, we've all got to come together and we've all got to fight this battle of the phone. But really, like, listening to you, it goes back to those first conversations, the first touch points at home, and having that, making the change you want to see within your house.
Yeah, it starts off small and then blend into the collective, blend into the community. Don't expect the community to save you, because it's broken. No. You have to start off in your own home with your own self. Go back to self.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ella.
Thank you for having me.